Hello, this is Connie Barlow. This week, Michael Dowd and I are bringing to you a podcast that is the last sermon that I gave while on the road. The previous podcast was Michael's final sermon here in the Puget Sound area, and this one I gave to the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Whidbey Island in Puget Sound. It's called Your Brain's Creation Story. And what you'll hear in here is that it's my view that bringing an understanding, thanks to science, of our brain's evolutionary history and how that evolutionary history deeply affects us today. It's called evolutionary psychology, evolutionary brain science. These understandings, it's my view that this sacred understanding of evolution that we gain from understanding our personal history is going to be the salvation of the liberal churches in the coming decades. Many conservative churches offer to people who come through their doors opportunities for personal salvation if their life is troubled with challenges, drug addiction, relationship issues, just personal psychological problems in their lives. And my view is that there is no better way to inculcate a sense of compassion for oneself and others, this prime spiritual virtue, and to gain practical tools for overcoming challenges. There's no better way than this evolutionary brain science understanding. So here it is, my final sermon for 7.5 years on the road. Well, good morning. It's a joy to be here again on Whidbey Island in this congregation. It's an honor to be here as well. My husband, Michael Dowd, will be here tomorrow night. Written up there in your order of service as to what he's going to be doing. But we have lived on the road for 7.5 years. And I have to admit, when we got here a week ago, I was needing a little bit of R&R. And I got that yesterday afternoon on one of the beaches here in Whidbey Island. So I'm back to myself again today. And that actually is going to be the theme today as well. Your brain's creation story. Michael and I have been on the road taking a sacred understanding of the 14 billion year story of evolution to audiences, whoever will take us in. Unitarian Universalists, my home denomination, my faith as an evolutionary humanist, Unitarian Universalist, you all have been the ones supporting us primarily on our journey. With Michael's new book that's out, paperback edition this past spring, he's been reaching further into Christian audiences where we know it's most important for making a difference in how things move in our culture in America, in how we move into a sustainable future, in how our religions are able to evolve to support the kind of human existence that we need as we're coming together as a planet. The title this morning is Your Brain's Creation Story, and I know as a UU, we are not scripturally based here, and so where are we drawing from so that it's more than just my opinion today up here? So I'd like to give you two senses of that. One, first turn to the very back of your order of service, and I'll show you which of our sources I'm drawing from today. The center left column on the back, that's the sources that we draw from. And if you go down to the fifth bullet point, it reads, humanist teachings that counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science and warns us against idolatries of the mind and spirit. So that we have other sources too, but just for today, the source I'm speaking from is the source that draws from science and is where we're looking to our own communities and our own species for guidance in how we move into the world. From another standpoint in terms of basis of authority here, I'd like to give you a reading. Here's one that comes from beloved nature writer, anthropologist, religious naturalist of the mid-20th century, early to mid-20th century, Loren Isley. Loren Isley wrote in one of his books, he wrote, "We are rag dolls made out of many ages and skins. We are changelings who have slept in wood nests and hissed in the uncouth guise of waddling amphibians. We have played such roles for infinitely longer ages than we have been human. He called himself a man in love with time. Evolution was his focus. And that didn't mean he was always cheery. One of the things I loved about him is that there was a very dark side to him as well. That seeing this deep evolutionary understanding, including our own human inclinations, can cause real challenges in our life, as it did with his, real challenges in his life. There is a dark side here. But the interesting thing is, if we look square at the dark side of our human nature, what we're born with, our inherited proclivities, which in some of us are more problems than in other of us, we take a square look at that. The amazing thing is the very first thing we come to by understanding its role in evolution is appreciation. Because for everything that troubles us in our lives and in the lives of people we love or the lives of people we don't love that end up troubling us too, everything made it possible for our ancestors to survive and reproduce. We would not be here were it not for those instincts. So I'll be talking about evolutionary brain science, evolutionary psychology today. This is cutting-edge stuff that's only been around for really less than 20 years. Some aspects of it go back to the 1950s. But owing to technology, functional MRI, where we can now start looking at what's going on in which parts of the human brain, and we can now understand for the first time how deep those challenges go back into our ancestry. How deep they are. So for this, I'd like to start with a couple pictures here. We'll start with these two. Since the 1950s, scientists, particularly Paul MacLean, studying the human brain just anatomically, just a dead brain being studied, comparing with different animal brains, really learned that we share a lot with animals alive today. And that, of course, hails back to our ancestors. Back about 300 million years ago, when there were no humans, no dinosaurs on this planet, but there were reptiles, and of course, our ancestors back then were reptiles, mammal-like reptiles. This is the part of the brain. This is a side view of the human brain now, the eye looking this way. This was a part of the brain that our ancestors had. They did not have these other aspects. This is the brainstem, the cerebellum. It's been called the reptilian brain. That is actually the name that scientists will refer to these parts of our brain. This is the basic life force. This is the part of our brain that acts instinctually for things of how to survive. If you're hungry right now, it's your reptilian brain in here. If we were to hear a loud noise at this instant, we would startle a little. Any of us who've been traumatized with post-traumatic stress disorder would startle a little more. These are things we don't have control over. And then after puberty, of course, this is the sex drive as well. But this is the basic safety and sustenance, life force part of the brain. Next to evolve, when mammals first evolved out of reptiles, is what we now call the emotional brain. It's the old mammalian brain. This is the limbic system, the emotional brain. And this is so easy to understand as to how emotions came in with mammals. Think about a turtle or a snake, female, goes off, lays its eggs under a log or in the sand somewhere, walks away. There would be no little baby being taken care of by the snakes, the turtles, the lizards. In fact, if an adult were to come back, and some of them might eat their own babies. There was no love involved at that level. When mammals came in, mammary glands supplying milk, right then you had the female-infant bond where the nurturing would happen. And out of that primordial mother-infant bond and the nurturing with milk, out of that began the whole emotions that then expanded out to kin, wider tribe, our whole species, and now all species on Earth. That sense of love and kinship comes from this part of our brain. So this is our emotional brain. Next to evolve, what's called the new mammalian brain, all mammals have some of this, but duck-billed platypuses, rabbits, and possums have very little of this. Dogs and cats and monkeys, dolphins have quite a lot of this. This is the neocortex. This is the rational brain. This is remembering something from the past, figuring out how it helped you, and then assessing your current situation such that you can use past experience to figure out what would be the best course of action in the future. This is the part of our brain. Now, of course, what it's thinking about best course of action in the future is to get these two parts of the brain what they want. Sustenance, safety, after puberty sex, and here, bonding, of friendship, status. Social mammals, very concerned with status. The higher status you have, it influences the kind of love that you have and your access to basic survival and food. So this part of our brain is involved in helping these below conscious parts of our brain get what they want. Finally, in humans and convergently in other mammals as well, this part of our brain, it's part of the neocortex, but it's now considered to be so distinctive that it's no longer just three parts of the brain, but four, our prefrontal cortex. This is the part where, for the first time, we have the ability to actually make a commitment, and then as the future unfolds, override these instincts. If you don't have this, you're just using your rational part of your brain to get these instincts what they want. And of course, sometimes this instinct is incompatible with this instinct, so you have a little bit of differences going on here. But this is the part where our commitments come in. This part, of course, is not developed at all in little infants. Anyone who's had a two-year-old knows that you don't rationally work with a two-year-old. You found other ways to be able to voluntarily have that child focus on something else. But by the age of 10 or so, this is pretty well in here. Kids can have a commitment to something that is important to them. I'm going to go out and build that tree fort, and they will be out there building that tree fort. Now, something unfortunate happens around puberty. And that's that the brain needs to rewire in order to have it be able to make choices of its own. As children, we're kind of inclined to listen to authority. But in order to have choices start coming in and personal experience influencing those choices, this has to rewire. The way I like to put it, you know what happens to a caterpillar before it becomes a butterfly? That's happening to the teen brain. And with functional MRI, we've really been able to see it. What this has allowed me is tremendous compassion for teenagers that I didn't have before. It also helps us understand how you don't need science. You just need to, like, watch to be able to understand what's going on. Car insurance companies, why is it that it costs more to insure a young person? Why does it cost twice as much to insure a teenage boy than a teenage girl? Not only are they lacking in this, but teenage boys may have 20 to 40 times the amount of testosterone that teenage girls. That's a sex hormone, testosterone. Testosterone is also the risk-taking hormone. Car insurance companies knew that. So this understanding helps make sense of some things we already know. Now, what Michael and I have done that's our contribution to this effort is that we've tried to make it a little more playful. And we've given names to those parts. Higher porpoise, higher purpose. Now, of course, monkey mind, this is a Buddhist term, but it's very appropriate. Because we have this rational thinking brain whose job is to think about the past, call up experiences from the past that may be useful for figuring out our present challenges, and then designing a course of action for the future, this monkey mind is living in the past and the future. So our meditation practices are trying to bring us back to the present moment. As a science person, I very easily go into a naturalist trance. So to calm my brain yesterday, which I got to do for 5 hours, all I had to do was go take a walk on the beach and then be taken up with the beautiful colors of the different seaweeds there and the sound of the eagles overhead and the crows. I mean, I was right there in the present moment. So we all have different techniques that we found to use to calm this monkey mind aspect here. Now, I'll start from the base up through here. Some of the practical things that we've learned on the road have most, from drawing from the science, have most moved and been useful to audiences of different ages. And I see we have different age groups in here as well, so I'll be working with that. Start off with the lizard legacy. This one is so amazing. How many of you have, like, taken a fall where your hands went out or a bike fall or just something where your body automatically did the right thing that had it not, you would be dead or deeply injured? You know, we've all had that experience. I remember sometimes before I learned this, I'd actually get up and I'd pat my body and I'd say, well done, body, because I knew I had not orchestrated that. Now I should say, well done, lizard legacy. It's this deep part of our brain, this instinctual reaction part of the brain that has done that. I'll ask kids, I'll say, do you remember the time when you learned to ride your bicycle for the first time without the training wheels or someone hanging on to you? That first time? And then ever after, there you were. It was what dancers call muscle memory. It's also deeply in here, in the cerebellum part of the lizard legacy here. It's where we don't have to think about it anymore. Now, the scary part about this is that there are also some things that can form down into the lizard legacy where we don't think about anymore and it just does it for us. And that's addictions. That's where we can have chemical addictions that go this far. And 2 weeks ago, I was doing a summer camp for UU kids. I had middle schoolers and I was talking with them about some of the really amazing science. Did you know that roundworms, little nematode worms, not even as sophisticated as an earthworm, these are roundworms, not segmented worms, roundworms have been found to get addicted to nicotine and suffer withdrawal effects. Remember a few weeks ago, there was legislation on nicotine and President Obama actually spoke about how hard it was for him to release himself from nicotine addiction because he started before the age of 18. We now know that while this is rewiring in the teenage years, if an addiction gets started and moves down as deep as the lizard legacy, it is very hard to get out of. So with the knowledge, we don't just have to tell kids anymore, don't do that, it's bad for you. It's like 10,000 years ago, when our ancestors were human, what was there to get addicted to? Yes, there was tobacco here in North America, but it wasn't concentrated. It wasn't nicotine. You didn't get up in the morning and smoke. It was used for sacred ceremonies. We didn't have alcohol 10,000 years ago. We had some fermented berries. Alcohol, of course, will often start in young people here, where if you get a little bit of alcohol at your party, you're no longer so self-concerned and inhibited. You can smile, you can dance, you can feel yourself, people like you better. So you start needing to have that in social circumstances. And then if it reaches down into the lizard legacy, then you have to have it. A century ago, before we had drug and alcohol treatment programs, if someone tried to release themselves from a deep alcohol addiction and got the DTs, they could die of that. This is deep. Honeybees have been found to get addicted to cocaine and suffer withdrawal. I mean, this is deep in our ancestry here. And of course, there were coca leaves in South America. People would go around, grab a little coca leaf, get a little hit, and be able to move on. But it wasn't concentrated cocaine. It wasn't concentrated in crack. Scientists call this mismatch. That is, the instincts that we have to work with are matched and arose out of a time before we have all the kinds of challenges that we have today. Our instincts say, if it feels good, do it and do it more. But we really didn't have those kinds of things 10,000 years ago. We didn't have video games. We didn't have internet pornography. In fact, here's an interesting story. I collect a lot of stories on the road from once people wake up to start thinking about challenges from the standpoint of our evolved and evolving brains, whole new ideas come in. I'm 57 years old, and I don't really understand a lot what's going on with the younger generation, so I have some spies of mine who are youngers, and I ask them, I say, tell me about this. So I was asking, I say, well, what's, you know, internet porn for the younger generation? Oh, everybody knows the internet is for porn. There's even a song about that. This is an addiction. This is a new addiction. A lot of Christian churches are having men's programs particularly for this. Is that our ancestors, male ancestors, 2,000% more sex drive than the average female, the average male will have. And, of course, us postmenopausal females, a lot more than we have. But the sex drive is such that if you visually see someone you're attracted to coming on to you, you're supposed to do something about that. And with the internet, it keys into something that isn't healthy. So I was asking her, I said, okay, tell me about that. And she says, well, I've learned to reconcile that, but in terms of the boys in her life. But she said, one new thing, a fascinating thing I came down to is, what's the equivalent of porn for the furry little mammal? I hadn't thought of this. I haven't read it anywhere. Romance novels. I'm not saying just, you know, that's it's only if it becomes an addiction, taking up a lot of time, and here's where the problems lie. We all know with the internet porn, if teenage boys are seeing perfect figures and women doing whatever they want them to do all the time, if they have a real life person finally come into their life, is that going to be an enjoyable experience if they're not perfect? Well, same thing with romance novels. If you expect that someone will come into your life who acts just like the hero of that story, you're going to have false expectations. So this sort of reframes for us a lot of our challenges that go on in our lives. Michael and I like to say that this evolutionary understanding helps us develop a prime spiritual virtue. And that is compassion for ourselves and for others. This stuff really, really helps for that. Part of the way it does this, and I've seen this work already with people, I've used it in my life now. If I'm experiencing a trouble, let's say I'm having some issues with codependence or something. Addictions, of course, will be mostly down in here. Codependence is the furry little mammal here. Let's say I'm having some issues with that. Well, it's not me. I don't have to go to a 12-step meeting and say, hi, I'm Connie and I'm codependent. No. I'm Connie and my furry little mammal right now at this moment is challenged with codependence. It's not who I am. It's part of me. Or you can be able to get someone out of denial and to show up for a recovery program. Hi, you know, I'm not an addict, but my lizard legacy has been mismatched for conditions now, and I got myself in a terrible situation, and I frankly need some help moving out of it. Can help us get out of denial and witness a little bit more. I know a young woman who is so great at this. In fact, I got an email from her recently. She's one of my sources into the younger culture, and she says, I just fell in love with a new man. She said, I'm so fascinated to kind of watch how my mind works while I'm engaged in it. That is, she's not diminishing the emotion, but she's watching herself. She actually says, when you understand this, you can stand back, and almost anything you can find some humor in, even if it hurts. You know? It's like this crazy situation. So it gives us an opportunity to witness compassion. Also, the aha experiences it can give us. I'd like to read one thing from another friend of ours, baby boomer age. She's been single her whole life, and she's been living alone for several decades. And she came to an insight once she understood this. She said, Therapy as it exists now is permeated with the assumption that the issues people struggle with arise out of their personal histories. It's not that this assumption is necessarily wrong, but very often the issues we struggle with are the same ones our ancestors, both human and pre-human, struggled with for millions of years. Many people go to therapy because of a vague feeling of discontent that cannot be articulated, because in reality, it springs from a pre-verbal ancient source. For example, our old mammalian brain, our furry little mammal, freaks out if it doesn't have a burrow and someone furry to cuddle with. No amount of talking can take away this brain's sadness and disease if these conditions are not satisfied. If you live alone, the real solution is to bring a furry mammal into your life. Cats and dogs have the same furry little mammal brain that we do. They do. They have the same furry little mammal brain that we do, and these brains understand each other. Late at night, Fatima the cat and I snuggle next. We snuggle next to the fire in my cozy brick burrow, and I know deep down that all is right with the world. My view is that this aspect of bringing a sacred understanding to evolution is going to be the salvation of the liberal churches in this century, in the coming decades. We Unitarian Universalists are the first to start with it, of bringing this in. But because we embrace evolution, we can actually look at our brain in a way that helps us witness, help us appreciate so that we're not in denial. However challenging it may be, this very condition served my ancestors. I would not be here without it. If we have a weight problem or so, even that, in terms of the volumes and kinds of foods available to us now, I mean, they weren't even around three generations ago when my Hungarian, Transylvanian, Unitarian grandmother was born in Hungary. I mean, she came to America because of the famines. It was great that she had genes that could put on weight, because every other winter or so, they'd have a massive famine and off would go the weight. Now those genes are here. I have to create a famine for myself. And so we can appreciate that too. That's not who I am. Of course it's that way. So we liberals can take this on, and I think particularly I have used this understanding for as young as first and second grade with puppets, having a higher purpose, bringing it in. I'll close with this story. A couple years ago, I was showing this chart and doing a program for middle schoolers and early teens. And I was asking him, I said, any of you remember in childhood or right now have a higher purpose? Something where your prefrontal cortex, where you have a commitment. So let's say an athletic sport where even if it's raining or you're hungry or you're sleepy, you go to practice anyway. You're overriding your instincts that say food, food, get food, or tired, or rain, cold, and you're doing it anyway. And many of them raise their hands. There was this one situation in Florida where a girl pointed to the girl next to her and said, oh, her higher purpose is being a runner. And that girl said, no, that's my dad's higher purpose. He got me into it. And the little girl said, yeah, but you win all sorts of rewards for it. And I said, oh, so your furry little mammal is feeling good with the status that you get by it. And so we were all laughing. The sense of how can you take this understanding and step back for a moment so that you can view your challenges in your life and others and have that compassion grow. Thank you.